Welcome to the Deadcast.
March 28th, 1979. The officer moved through the cramped apartment, inching towards the smell. It was a familiar, unpleasant scent that he could not place. What with all the other smells in the apartment, the most overpowering of all being that of body odor. He passed into the back room of the apartment and paused. The scent was stronger here, almost cloying. It seemed to be coming from the padlocked door standing at the back of the room. The occupant of the apartment, a local celebrity known as Ira Einhorn, said he did not have a key to the small closet.
After a few moments of trying, the officer was able to pry the hasp away from the wood. He opened the closet, unsure of what to expect. Inside was a mishmash of stacked boxes, many of them bearing the name Maddox. He began the arduous task of removing the objects inside the closet, until all that remained was a large, dark green streamer trunk. It, too, was locked. Again, Einhorn said he did not have a key, and the officer was forced to break the lock. Upon doing so, he lifted the lid, tension building in his body as he did so. What could be inside? At first, all he could see was newspapers. He moved them aside, revealing a layer of styrofoam. Digging into this a few inches, he stopped, frozen. There was a hand reaching up out of the styrofoam towards him, as if beckoning him. The officer stood and walked back into the main apartment. He looked at Ira Einhorn and supposedly said, "It looks like we've found Holly." Einhorn, his face an unreadable mask behind the large mound of hair that hung from his chin, replied, "You've found what you found." Hello again, and welcome to the third episode of the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us this week, and apologize for the show not being out when it was supposed to be on Friday. I had planned to do a different story this week, but unfortunately the Black Plague broke out in our house, and everyone ended up getting sick, leaving me with no time to do the research necessary to tackle the story I'd wanted to. So, this week we're going to be tackling a story which has always fascinated me, that of the murder of Holly Maddox at the hands of Ira Einhorn, also known as the Unicorn. I will be posting photographs from this week's episode over at Author Totten on Instagram. You can also follow me on Twitter at Author Totten. That's T-O-T-T-E-N. You can find me on Facebook at Ian Totten Author. And if you'd like to help out the Deathcast and donate so that we can get things like new headphones and a better microphone, you can head on over to Patreon and find me under Author Totten. Now, let's dive into the crypt. As we heard there in the trailer, police found what they suspected to be the body of Holly Maddox inside a streamer trunk in the back of her boyfriend Ira Einhorn's apartment. Holly had been missing for 18 months prior to this. Einhorn was a leader in the hippie counterculture movement. We're going to get to that in a few minutes. We're going to look at how the police ended up at Einhorn's door in the first place. When Holly had initially gone missing, they had questioned Einhorn, who was a local celebrity in Philadelphia, and he had told them that he had been taking a shower while Holly had gone out to go and buy tofu and bean sprouts, and that he had never seen her again. At the time she had gone missing, it was known among their friends that Einhorn and Maddox had broken up, and that Einhorn was infuriated over the young blonde girl spurning his advances. After Holly's disappearance, Ira went on with his life as though nothing had happened. He still was a regular fixture in the counterculture movement, schmoozing with various socialites, including members of the Broffman family. Now, if you don't know who the Broffmans are, they are the family that gave us Seagram's wine cooler, and in fact, two of the Broffmans were recently embroiled in the Nexium scandal, which was where Kurt Raynard was running a sex cult disguised as a self-help group. He had Sarah and Claire Broffman helping him with this. The Broffman we're talking about in this case, however, was Claire and Sarah's mother, Barbara Broffman. She, along with many other very influential people, were under the sway of Einhorn, who was a very charismatic man. So these are the type of people that Ira Einhorn was ingratiating himself to. The police came back to speak with Einhorn after his downstairs neighbors had made a complaint to their landlord about a pungent odor in their apartment. The landlord had called a plumber thinking that it was an issue with the drains when a large brown stain began spreading across the tenant's ceiling. Einhorn refused the plumber admission into the section of his apartment that could possibly be causing it. And from everything that I was able to find, it seems that things went cold at that point for a little while. They wouldn't remain that way, however. Holly's family had hired a private investigator to look into her disappearance, and he was eventually able to get the Philadelphia Police Department to take another look at Einhorn. And so it was that Detective Mike Chitwood arrived at the Guru's apartment on the fateful day that Holly's body was discovered. He was arrested. He professed his innocence the entire time, although it should be noted that officers involved in the case said he had a very detached, almost dispassionate attitude about the whole thing. His lawyer at the time, future Senator Arlen Specter, who would leave the case right after this, was able to get Ira's bail set at $40,000, which in a murder case is extremely low. He only had to post 10% of that, which was $4,000. Detective Mike Chitwood would later say that as soon as he heard the price of the bail, he knew that Einhorn was going to flee the country, and that is eventually what happened, although we're getting ahead of ourselves. Ira had a lot of damage control to do once he got out of lockup. His supporters had to be reassured that there was no way he could possibly have murdered Holly because he was a non-violent, peace-loving hippie guru who had helped to found Earth Day. And there are two stories out there of what he told his supporters. The first one was that he had no idea that Holly's body was inside the streamer trunk in his closet, and that it had to have been planted there by the CIA. He said this, and they believed it, because as Ira was able to spin it, he had been on the CIA's radar since the late 1960s as an enemy of theirs. The other story he spun was that he had come home to his apartment and found Holly's body lying in the middle of his apartment. And panicked, he had placed it inside the streamer trunk and hidden it, knowing that it had been the CIA and the FBI who had killed her in order to set him up. And I mean, we look at it from 2020 eyes, but even back in the late 1970s, it says something to the magnetic nature of his personality that people actually bought these lies that he was giving them. because if somebody just came out and said, oh, you know, the CIA plant must have planted the body in their my house, most people are gonna, you know, nod their heads and, yeah, you got it, while thinking to themselves, you're full of shit, bud. But Ira was such a charismatic individual, he was able to get his followers to believe what he was saying, and it was important for him to do this because he lived off of the largesse of his supporters. They financed his lifestyle, and from all accounts, Ira lived a very high-profile lifestyle. Even while professing the, you know, to want to live a life of poverty, he dined out often. He held court in a local bistro that was fairly swanky, from what I understand. He seemed to enjoy being the center of attention and living life high on the hog. And I found a few different descriptions of Ira Einhorn. They all say pretty much the same thing, that he was a very intense, persuasive man who really, he was the kind of person that could have sold reading glasses to a blind man. The one thing that stuck out about Ira more than anything else, however, was his smell. He apparently was the epitome of the dirty hippie. Everyone who came into contact with Ira remarked on the fact that he absolutely reeked of body odor. And those that were close to him have stated he was actually a very clean and fastidious man, but he had this image and aura he had to protect. So he would bathe on a daily basis, but afterwards he would put on the same pair of clothes he had been wearing for God alone knows how long. And it was from these clothes that the stench of Ira emanated. So I'm looking at his character and just the basic facts that we know about him. It seems that Ira was a bit of a con man, especially given the crime that he was accused of. And the lies that he spun around it to try and convince others that he had nothing to do with it. And he further shows this when, just days before he was set to appear in court for the first time in 1981, Ira Einhorn fled the United States. He was aided in his flight by Barbara Broffman, who helped him get out of Philadelphia, and he eventually ended up in Ireland, where, as the story goes, on a dark and stormy night, he appeared at the home of a man and his family looking for a place to stay. And although the man told him that he had knocked on the wrong door, he did offer to let Ira stay with the family. This lasted until the man and his family were set to come to the United States to visit with relatives, and Ira told him not to mention his name, and that if he did, they would likely try and extradite him, which at the time was not a possibility, as Ireland did not have an extradition treaty with the United States. Anyway, Ira's new landlord's curiosity was piqued by his statements, and upon coming to the United States, he and his relatives checked around with various newspapers and news organizations to try and find out what it was that Ira had been alluding to, at which point they were put into contact with the Philadelphia Police Department, who informed them what it was Ira had been accused of. Upon returning to Ireland, the man reported that he got home and immediately said to Ira, "You have 20 minutes to get out of my house. You know what this is about." After which, he did not see Ira Einhorn again for a number of years. Now, we're going to leave Ira and his fugitive flight for a few moments and delve into the backgrounds of both Ira Einhorn and the woman he was accused of murdering, Holly Maddox. Ira Samuel Einhorn was born May 15, 1940 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, into a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. Interviews with close childhood friends of Einhorn describe him as a likable yet gruff young man who liked to get into fights. Growing up, he really didn't display any of the charisma that he would in later life, but it was noted that he seemed to be unusually bright and crave being the center of attention, with one friend remarking how Einhorn had gone away to summer camp and worked out the entire time that he was there, and upon coming back had grown 5 or 6 inches and was absolutely jacked, so much so that the other bullies in the neighborhood would not pick on him. After graduating high school, he went off to college, notably at the University of Pennsylvania, where he received his undergraduate degree in English in 1961. It was at college that he became involved in ecological groups and the just-budding counterculture movements. After he left Philadelphia, Einhorn traveled around the country quite a bit, going to all the famous hippie enclaves, including the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, down into LA, into the Canyon area, really immersing himself in this new movement. And it was during this time that he began to establish himself as something of an authority figure within the hippie movement. He had a very forceful personality. Ira was the type of person who would not take no for an answer. And perhaps a bit of foreshadowing, when he was denied what he wanted, he was known to have a bit of a dark side. But he was very good at keeping this darker side of his personality under wraps. Among these circles that Ira floated through, people began to refer to him as the Unicorn. And in German, his last name, Einhorn, means one horn or unicorn. Ira seems to have embraced this moniker, seeing himself as something of a mythical figure. It's very telling that he embraced the moniker, but also it shows what he thought of himself, which was that he was larger than life. Friends later in life would say of him, after he had fled from justice, that he would put on those days-old clothes, and he was putting on his Ira outfit. He was assuming a role that he had created for himself, this public persona, and through this public persona, he was able to weave in and out of the lives of everyone involved in the hippie movement. He was a very impassioned speaker, and because of this, the media started paying attention to him. And I suppose at this point, Ira is almost forgotten due to his crimes, but at his peak, he was up there with individuals like Abbie Hoffman, Allen Ginsberg, and Timothy Leary. He was a big name within the counterculture. One of the reasons for this was that forceful personality that I talked about a moment ago. Ira wasn't the type of person who would go along with what everyone else was doing. He would hijack it, because in his mind, it had to be done this way and no other way. One of the things that brought him into contact with all these different people in the counterculture movement was that Ira took up work at various universities. At one point in the 1964-65 school year, he worked at Temple University, although at the end of the academic year, he was let go after it was discovered that he was talking to his students about using acid and marijuana. And not in an acceptable manner. He wasn't the kind of person to stand up there and say, no, drugs are bad. He was actually espousing the virtues and dangers of them. Ira eventually ended up back at the University of Pennsylvania, and around 1970 that he first met Holly Maddox. Helen Holly Maddox was born in 1947. She was the oldest of five siblings, born in Tyler, Texas. Growing up, Holly was an outgoing, fun-loving person. She was a dancer as well as a cheerleader. Someone that her sisters described as always being positive. Upon graduating from high school, Holly was accepted into Bryn Mawr College, which isn't too terribly far from the Philadelphia area. Upon graduating from college, Holly stayed in the area because she enjoyed it. Being from the small town of Tyler, I'm sure going to Philadelphia was, you know, like going to Hollywood. At any rate, at some point during 1970, she and a group of friends went to the bistro that Ira Einhorn held court at, and as a friend later described it, Ira, who was tall, disheveled looking, and fat, took one look at the lithe, beautiful Holly, and it was love at first sight. I've seen it described in a couple of areas as Beauty and the Beast, because Ira was a very unattractive man, whereas Holly was what would be considered in really any age as a natural beauty. Now, Ira should be noted, he was considered something of a ladies' man by his friends. He never lacked for female companionship. In fact, it's been said that the only time you saw him at his apartment, he was either arriving with a woman or leaving with a woman. So I guess in modern parlance, we could say Ira had game. And for Holly, who had been fairly sheltered in high school, I've seen different things from her sisters where they said that, yeah, she was a really pretty young woman, but she didn't have a lot of experience with boys. She was easy game for Ira. He immediately began spinning his web around her and blew her mind with his worldviews. And it was after only something like 6 weeks that they were living together at Ira's apartment. From the outside, it appeared that they had a perfect relationship. But remember how I talked about Ira was not the type of person who took no for an answer? Diaries that were found after Holly's body was discovered reveal a much darker, more sinister relationship where Ira treated her as little more than a slave. One entry that I saw, she said something to the effect of, "Hitting people is never a sign of love." Another entry reads, "He follows me, won't let me go, frustrated because he has the power." In another entry, she describes how Ira carried her into the bedroom, wrestled her to the floor, and how what followed was a violent, horrible scene. Now, I'm not saying that he raped her in that passage, but from the little bit of it that I was able to read, it certainly seems to me that that's what was implied. So these few passages, they paint a very different picture of Ira Einhorn than what was available to the public at the time. He was a physically and emotionally abusive person, and years later, when he finally was physically brought to trial, Ira, showing his ego, took the stand and admitted to beating two girlfriends prior to going out with Holly. And that's something I found in researching this time period in America that isn't talked about very much. There's a lot of violence among men and women that's really not brought up. There's the talk of peace, love, and harmony, but there's a dark undercurrent. And I really think that's something that I should dive into as the podcast progresses, and maybe this is a good starting point for it. Back to Ira and Holly, because of the reasons stated, and I'm sure many more that we'll never fully know about, the two of them broke up quite often, getting back together at later dates. In one of Holly's diary entries, she even states that she wants to leave him but finds herself powerless to do so, and that she continuously finds herself returning to the situation, which has all the hallmarks of battered woman syndrome. I will give you a further illustration of this. In one of the documentaries that I watched on the case, they talk about when she went to her family's for, it was either Thanksgiving or Christmas, and prefaced their arrival by saying, "I'm bringing somebody with me, you're not gonna like him," which the family immediately knew was not a good sign. The sisters went on to recount how the Holly who had left for college so many years earlier was not the Holly who showed up at their house. It was more of a beaten dog than it was a happy, life-loving young woman, and that she basically kowtowed to Ira's every whim. Things came to something of a head while they were having dinner, and while the family was on their first plate, Ira helped himself to seconds, after which he leaned back in his chair and placed his feet up on the dining room table, which, having been to Texas, you'd get shot over or something like that, if not severely beaten. So this is the kind of relationship that Holly Maddox found herself in, and the two of them were together for about 5 years before Holly, now age 30, realized that she couldn't go on being with this man who saw her as nothing more than a possession, and decided to leave him. She moved to New York City and ended up in a relationship with a man named Saul Lapidus. This entire situation enraged Ira. Again, he was not a man who accepted the word no. And he often told friends during this period that Holly would come back to him. She had before. And apparently they were in contact over this period of time. Ira informed her that she needed to come to the apartment and get her stuff, or he would throw it out into the street. And after several failed attempts to get friends to go over and retrieve her property for her, Holly Maddox went to Ira's apartment on September 9th, 1977. Evidence later showed that Holly had been bludgeoned about the head, crushing parts of her skull, before being placed inside of the steamer trunk. Now, the really horrific thing about this, beyond the fact that Ira Einhorn killed this young woman, was that when he placed her inside of the steamer trunk, Holly was still alive. The detective who initially opened the trunk quickly realized why the hand was outstretched, and that's that Holly had been clawing at the inside of the steamer trunk in an attempt to escape. And obviously Einhorn ignored her. I would imagine that Holly was able to communicate in some fashion despite the injuries to her head, so I can't think that it was completely silent inside the apartment while she was inside the steamer trunk. More likely than not, Ira took great pleasure in the fact that he had placed her in there alive and that she suffered terribly before dying. Seeing interviews with the man, he's very egocentric, and he just comes across as the type of person that would enjoy inflicting something like that on another person who had displeased him, who, you know, had dared to defy him. You have to imagine this young 30-year-old woman. She's injured, she's terrified, and she's trapped inside this trunk in the dark, knowing that the other person is outside and that they could save her if they wanted to, but they think so little of her that they refuse. That's almost a fate worse than death, in my opinion. And that's something that I hope people walk away from this episode thinking about, not so much Ira Einhorn, but the person that he killed so callously, who he thought so little of that he just threw them inside the box and forgot about them. Because that's really what he did. After Holly disappeared and the police came around, he went on with his life as though nothing had happened, living high on the hog, as it were, until 1981, when he went on the lam. Back in Ireland, after he left his rented accommodations, it was about 5 years later that this same man who had been renting him the room saw Ira again as he was going into his place of employment. He was going in, Ira was coming out, and supposedly Ira became irate with him and began making threats to the man, telling him to stop following him, to which the man replied, "I'm not following you, this is where I work," and Ira got even angrier and stormed away from him. And this was around 1985 or 86. Ira was not seen again, although the police in Philadelphia were still actively seeking him. In fact, they had nearly caught Einhorn on two occasions, both times arriving just days and or hours after he had fled the area. It is known that Ira was helped while he was on the lam by the Brofman family up until at least 1988, when Barbara Brofman read a book about the case and realized just exactly what the evidence the police had against her friend was, and cut off his funding, at which time she did contact the police and let them know where to look for Ira. At one point when they went to try and apprehend him, instead they found a woman by the name of Annika Floden, who was a Swedish woman, and she actually plays a part in the story later on, which I'll get to when I get there. Now we are into the 90s, and in late 1994, the state of Pennsylvania put Einhorn on trial in absentia, and he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Now, this is important because eventually Einhorn would be found. In the late 90s, he was discovered in a village called Champagne, Moulton, France, where he'd been living under the name of Eugene Malone. He was arrested, but because of the trial in absentia, the country of France refused to extradite him. The reason they did this is a lot of European countries will not extradite someone to a country that has the death penalty. And even though Einhorn had not been sentenced to death, there was a fear that were he to be returned to America, he would be put to death. So he was let go. Not long after this, however, Annika Floden was spotted attempting to get a French driver's license under the name of Anika Houdin Malone because she and Einhorn had been married at some point. And again, the American embassy attempted to get Einhorn extradited to the United States. This went back and forth quite a bit because in many European countries, when someone is convicted in absentia, they are guaranteed a new trial upon being found. So in 1998, the state of Pennsylvania passed what became known as Einhorn's Law, which stated that if he were returned to America, he could have a new trial if he requested it. And again, it went back and forth a number of times with France not believing that this would actually happen. And eventually, Einhorn took it to the European Court of Human Rights, who bounced it back to the country of France. And eventually, the president of France decided to grant America their request and send Einhorn back. Now, remember, Ira Einhorn, if nothing else, he was a con man, almost Carney-like. He was a showman. So what he did was he took a blunt butter knife and slashed his throat superficially, and then had his wife call a reporter to the house. And you can actually find this interview online. In fact, I'm gonna play a few seconds of it here. Ira Einhorn sitting at his kitchen table, shirt covered in blood. You can actually see inside his neck. The first thing you're gonna hear is his French lawyer on the phone with him, and it's hard to decipher. I had to look around on the internet a little bit to find out what he said. He tells Ira to do something stupid, to which Ira replies, "It's already underway."
Ira, don't do nothing stupid.
Sir. I told him, Ira, do nothing stupid. He told me it's in process.
We'll have to call the doctor so that he can send to me. And,
Jospin a créé. He is responsible. He is the Prime Minister. He's responsible for all the people, not just the Hope Gun. Vous avez un scoop? Utilisez le scoop, but donnez. Je parle avec Claire Vaquet. Je fais ça. Pour créer le fond de ma vie, and je parle avec Claire Vaquet dans le même temps. Because j'ai le désir pour dire avec mon corps. Cette situation, ce n'est pas bien. One at a time. I have something to say very directly to Mr. Jospin. Il crée ça. I want him to regard this. And I want him to begin speaking to his people, to remember that he's a socialist, to remember that he was a Trotskyite, to remember that he was part of my generation who cared about people, and we still care.
As you can hear from that clip, Ira is still playing the part of Ira, the hippie guru, and refusing to take responsibilities for his actions. Which is, you know, I've read that's a sign of a narcissist. You know, he's passing the buck along to somebody else. Ira Einhorn's not being extradited to the U.S. because he took the life of an innocent person. No. He is passing this along, his throat slashing along, and placing an at the feet of the president, blaming him for it. As I said, it was a superficial wound. In typical fashion, Ira was grandstanding, refused medical treatment. Eventually, he was led out of the house. He was able to get into the ambulance of his own volition. And on July 20th, 2001, Ira Einhorn was extradited to the United States, roughly 20 years after having initially fled. I've seen numerous interviews with the family where they're talking about the ups and downs of, you know, is he coming back? Isn't he coming back? And when they finally got the word that he was coming back, the brother expressed some doubt because they'd been told this numerous times. So I have to imagine the elation they had upon it actually happening was beyond their wildest dreams. So in October of 2002, over a full year after he was returned to the United States, Ira Einhorn went on trial for the murder of Holly Maddox. During trial, one witness stated that around the time of the murder, she did hear a woman's screams for help, but did nothing. Once again, his ego had to run wild, and Ira took the stand in his own defense, which, as most lawyers will tell you, is suicide. Einhorn was forced on the stand to read excerpts from his diary written around the time of Holly's death, in which he admitted being angry over her leaving him. But he later stated, although he was angry with her, he was able to control himself and not act on those emotions. Something that was contradicted later in his testimony when he stated that he had beaten two previous girlfriends. And he went on to recount a tale wherein both the FBI and CIA had killed Holly in an attempt to frame him due to his investigation of both the Cold War and psychotronics. Knowing what we do of Ira Einhorn's personality and his makeup, it's pretty obvious that he had to have that time in the limelight, in the camera. He had to be the star of his trial, and naturally it did not go in his favor. On October 17th, 2002, it went to deliberation, and after 2 hours, Ira Einhorn was found guilty of murder in the first and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Initially, he was sentenced to SCI Houtsdale before being transferred to SCI Laurel Highlands, which is a minimum security prisoner that provides care for inmates with health needs. One little aside here, I've watched a number of videos with the family of Holly, especially her brother. He looks like Jim Varney, the actor who played Ernest P. Worrell, but he's a very tight, terse Texan. And I got the impression in watching him as he spoke that probably the greatest joy he could have in his life beyond having his sister back would be to smash Ira Einhorn in the mouth as hard as he could. So I'm certain that this next bit of news brought a gleam of joy into his eye. On April 3rd, 2020, Ira Einhorn died at the age of 79. From natural causes. That's it for this week. I hope you've enjoyed the Deathcast. Our book of the week is The Unicorn Secrets by Stephen Levy. Stay morbid. Thank you.
The Dead Cast.